Hello and welcome to Fourth Estate, the live media and current affairs panel show on 2SER and the Community Radio Network for the week commencing the 10th of August 2015. I'm Lucy Robson and on today's show we're talking clickbait, ice cream and the continuing crisis of Q&A. Joining me in the studio are Managing Editor of Junkie, Steph Harmon.
Hello.
We have Investigative Humorist and Digital Video Strategist Dan Illick.
Good to be with you.
And on the phone from Melbourne, we have cracky reporter Josh Taylor.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
To have your say on the issues that we're discussing, get in touch via Twitter. Our handle is at Fourth Estate AU, all letters, no numbers. Now, first up, after a fairly friendly comment piece from Crikey last week, it came to light that the Australian Financial Review's editor-in-chief, Michael Stutchbury, has been encouraging staff to use the curiosity gap when writing headlines. These are headlines that have some kind of promise and tempt the reader to click, and if you're not so PC about it, you could also use the term clickbait. But what's the most correct way to refer to it? Should we still be using the term clickbait, or do you prefer curiosity gap, Steph?
I think the words mean different things to different people now. I think the word clickbait was always kind of misappropriated. It started off being used as just like trashy news on the internet, and then it started becoming things like 7 ways you're killing your own children, and just, you know, like articles that you couldn't not click and feel good in your conscience. And now it means all manner of sins, including, you know, the aforementioned examples, but also that curiosity gap. Something that's just about Kim Kardashian sometimes gets called clickbait. Mm. BuzzFeed gets called clickbait all the time for its use of listicles, although their editor-in-chief would say that they don't do clickbait because they define it differently. So there's a lot of different definitions for that term.
They define it differently? What? How do they define it?
Well, they define it as the curiosity gap, and say that they haven't done clickbait for a couple of years now because they don't do the curiosity gap.
I've also noticed Upworthy have slowly kind of moved away from making clickbaity type headlines, and they are trying to do more of that curiosity gap as well.
Well, if Upworthy have stopped doing it, then it must be very passé. So what changed? People's attention spans or fatigue? What happened?
I think I think Upworthy is a really interesting example. I've stopped seeing Upworthy in my Facebook feed as much as I used to, and I think that a lot of people have. And
it's working. It's a bad strategy.
Yeah, exactly.
Get back to clickbait, guys.
Well, I think it's more than that. I think it was a lot of fatigue. I think people started being like, you know, you want to share stuff that makes you look smutty or funny or smutty, which is a cool combo of
smutty,
funny and smart.
Smutty is money. and smart and funny.
Smutty,
yeah, so like that, those Upworthy things have just been so overdone and they're so overwrought as well. And I think people just stopped wanting to appear as overwrought, you know.
Yeah, I think Upworthy have started to still share the same kind of content, but they're trying to break it down and write stories about it. So they're trying to add more value to going to see a bit of Upworthy content rather than just, you know, the 3-second thing that they found.
Yeah, they used to just be repackaging YouTubes, basically.
Yeah.
I think it's probably also important to point out that, you know, they all sort of stopped doing it when, you know, The Onion launched their clickbaity website Clickhole. And that was kind of, you know, when, at the point where it was like, well, if we can parody this so well, then maybe it's time to actually move on from that as well. I think that Clickhole is still producing amazing, hilarious send-ups of this content and all this, the new stuff that you seem to come along every day. But, yeah, I think a lot of the sites are trying to change it because it just doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, I think I will still get sucked into it. Like I will definitely go and read a Junkie article from time to time. I would.
Oh, that's good to hear. What about more?
What a meano.
So what does work now then?
Well, I think people are a little bit smarter with what they're engaging with, and they're a bit smarter with what they're sharing. And they, you know, I don't think people are as inclined to just go for the easy click. What works, you know, I think the curiosity gap is a really interesting example. You do need to have the payoff. You need to have, if there's a promise for something good, you need to be able to deliver it.
Also, this is nothing new. Like headlines in papers, in physical papers, are always trying to tickle your curiosity bone. I think we're an organization like AFR gets in trouble is that their brand is known for hard business news. And if you're promising something, if you allude to promising something one way, but not delivering on that promise, then that's the disconnect for the audience. So the audience will go, oh, what is that? Oh, that's not what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. And I think that was, you know, in that Crikey article as well, it pointed out a lot of Fairfax headlines that were doing similar things, like encouraging that curiosity gap. And it does seem a little bit out of place for that. And it does feel weird when you're on the Sydney Morning Herald website, for instance, and you see those kinds of headlines that are like, she couldn't believe it happened to her. The thing is, not many people are engaging with the full page of websites anymore, like the front page of
It's newspapers. A pretty good headline, particularly if you're trying to encourage people to find out what Gina Rinehart thinks about not getting a board seat. So
I think I'll bring Josh in here. You wanted to add to this?
Yeah, I understand the frustration from the journalist point of view from these traditional sites. I mean, I have experienced it myself where I've written something in my last job at the DNet, and I've seen it repackaged on pedestrian or junkie or something as something a lot more, curiosity gap type headline. And that is frustrating from a journalist point of view, because you're like, well, we could have gone for that headline, but, you know, we're a different type of publication, so it doesn't exactly work for us. So I can understand why they would potentially be looking to, I guess, bridge that gap a little bit. But yeah, you're right. There are certain, if they have a certain established brand that they don't want to sort of detour too far.
For Crikey, I'm interested to know, like, because it is a subscription site, do you have to game audiences like that?
Yeah, so I think there is probably a tiny little bit of curiosity gap in what we do. Thankfully, we have very talented people who write a lot of the headlines and know how to sort of get audiences in. But it's kind of a mixture. It's not really sort of, I guess, dragging people in and making them want to, you know, click subscribe. We kind of, you can tease it out a little bit, but I don't think we do super clickbaity, thankfully.
We're in the business, we talk about A/B headline testing and things like that. So putting out a headline and it gets tested to a certain number of audience, and whatever headline gets more clicks, that one gets changed to that headline. But I know for Upworthy, for instance, they have A to I think X headline testing. If you're a content curator for Upworthy, it's your job to write 24 headlines. And out of those 24 headlines, you put it into a bit of a black box, into an algorithm, and then that algorithm will mishmash you a headline out of that. And they found that to be the most effective way of writing headlines. It's incredible. It's amazing.
Yeah, I think traditional outlets have stuff to learn from digital outlets. But yeah, I think that ultimately, if you do anything too much, it backfires. And I think that a lot of outlets are realizing that.
I think for AFR, this is truly just a brand problem. They just are forgetting who they are, and they're not speaking with the right voice.
So could that alienate readers eventually, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
or
I mean,
already?
I'm a subscriber to Fairfax, and I get annoyed that I have to see ads, and I pay them $15 a month. You know, like I would love to, you know, what exactly am I getting from my $15 a month? Anyway, like I think clickbaity headlines will eventually annoy subscribers and readers.
Well, it's about shares as well, I've heard. That's the new thing. As the BuzzFeed editor-in-chief Ben Smith wrote, last year you can trick someone to click, but you can't trick someone to share. And aren't shares more important than clicks in 2015, Steph?
Oh, they're hugely important to us. I can't speak for traditional outlets like AFR or Fairfax, but that's where we get most of our traffic from. We get about 70% of our traffic comes through Facebook. I think Upworthy have said, going back to Upworthy, they write headlines not for their readers, but for their readers' friends. So you're writing a headline so that when your reader shares it on Facebook, their friends click on it.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I think it's not just the headlines anymore, though. A lot of it is images as well. I think that plays a huge part. Like, one of the things of ours that went really well recently was, like, you know, I did quite a long piece on immigration and how much it's actually costing us to keep asylum seekers in Nauru. Now, that sort of story generally probably wouldn't get, that much traffic, but we put an infographic with it comparing all the different costs, you know, staying, putting them in education, keeping them in jail, stuff like that. And that has actually really done well for us. So I think it's not just the headlines that people are seeing anymore. It's also, I think, images are hugely important now as well.
I definitely agree with that. I think any time you can make a dense story like that more accessible to an audience who is who's scant on time. That's a perfect way of creating great content for the digital space. The next big barrier that publishers like Junkee and Crikey and Fairfax and AFR are going to have to juggle is the idea that they will then have to start publishing to Facebook's own proprietary publishing service. So that is the next big foundation. And if Facebook treat YouTube, if the Facebook going to treat publishers the way they treat YouTube, eventually they're going to retrograde all of the links going to those big publishers' websites and artificially inflate all the leaks coming from the in-house publishing tools so that Facebook keeps the money. So that direct publishing to the platforms, mainly Facebook, which is the issue now, is going to be the next big challenge for the media companies to come to grips with. And that's what's going to be really crippling for everyone.
And the worst part is you have no choice but to play along.
There's no choice. Yeah. There's no good option. And it's so hard to figure out. I mean, it's like, what do you say? Hey, Mark Zuckerberg, can you not make so much money? Then give us a fair go.
I don't get it. If Taylor Swift can fight back against Apple Music, why can't we fight back against Facebook?
Do you know what? Here's the reason why. Because there are enough players out there who will just rip off Crikey's content through and put it through Facebook's publishing arm as their own brand, and then they will do the rev share with Facebook. You already said that happening with videos. There's a great article that came out this week by a YouTuber who is lamenting the fact that Facebook, his term is freebooting, users are stealing his YouTube videos and putting them on Facebook, and they're building their brands and they're building the ads around that work. And so there's this already huge IP stoush between YouTube and Facebook. And what we're seeing is, as YouTube is still growing and Facebook video is growing so much faster, and it's catching up to YouTube. So yeah, it's playing with Facebook is the next big problem for digital publishers.
This is Fourth Estate. I'm Lucy Robson, and I'm joined by Dan Illick, Steph Harmon, and Josh Taylor. Last week, the Sweet Tooth community of Australia rejoiced at the announcement of a new product: tubs of Golden Gay Time ice cream. Supposedly, the work of a social media hero, Jesse James McElroy, and his Facebook page, Golden Gay Time Ice Cream Tub Project. This victory may not have been as sweet as it first seemed. Josh, can you tell us what you found out about the Golden Gay Time ice cream?
Yeah, so I went through the Facebook page and had a look at the likes. And so essentially the site started about a month before the launch. And then it was fairly flat on the number of likes. And then the 2 days before the announcement, it just shot up to like a bit over 4,000, I think, when I last checked it. And that really didn't sort of seem very right. So I had a look at a couple of the people who were involved. And although they've all denied that they have any ties to streets or anything like that, but they all work for marketing and advertising agencies. So there is something a little bit sus there. So I put it to streets about it, and they still deny it. But, you know, a lot of the sites sort of ran it as though streets were responding to this campaign, which, you know, only lasted a month and barely had any likes. So I have a deep suspicion of these sorts of grassroots movements and you know, Facebook like groups popping up now, and I guess marketing companies using them as a platform to sell a product, I guess.
What's wrong with that?
It's just the cynical journalist in me that just, you know, doubts the reality of these sorts of things now.
Well, good work with that. But I'm sure that you've done more intense investigative work in your career, Josh.
Yeah, you've totally smashed open the ice cream cartel.
But what I'm trying to say is, why didn't anyone else think to look at that, do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it was just an easy, nice story for them. I think that a lot of people were sort of very, very excited about the prospect of Golden Gay Time ice cream, that they were keen to get the story up as quickly as possible. So they all seemed to sort of just take it verbatim. And yeah, I don't know. So Street sent me the original press release, and they claim that they made no mention of this guy's group, but obviously everyone's already been given the same information because everyone ran with that same angle. So either they're all copying each other or there's something else going on there. So it only really took me about 20 minutes. So I don't know why people just didn't sort of look into it a bit further. I don't know.
Oh, because it's so much easier to turn out a story.
Yeah, totally.
We went one step further. We went down to we went all over Sydney to try and find some because it was actually sold out all around the place. We went to three different supermarkets where it was empty shelves, and we eventually tracked one down at the 7-Eleven on that in Oxford Street in Paddington, and it was
everybody
out the,
go there.
It was out, it was, it was out the back, and we brought a tub, two tubs back to Fairfax, and we made our Fairfax journalists eat them and give a review. And apparently, it's not very good. It's not very good. Not enough crunchy bits. So it's a bit of a disappointment.
I couldn't find any in the Melbourne CBD, and I eventually found some sort of in the outskirts of the city on the weekend. But then I was going to buy it, and then I'm like, no, that's just letting them win. And I decided against it. But, we were comparing it in the office too. I don't know if you remember a couple of months ago, Uber ran a campaign where they were saying that they were going to deliver kittens to people's offices, and the only people who seemed to actually get the kittens were journalists who were going to write it up. So it was a bit of, is this an actual promotion or is this just sort of, getting a bit of coverage in the media?
No one was delivering kittens to a bucket factory, were they?
But I think, media stunts have been around forever. And I guess it's important to underline the fact that there's no proof that this, there's no proof yet is a media stunt. I think I've seen, campaigns like this go viral quite organically about food in particularly. They do pick up steam really quickly. But in general, we at Junkie, we just treat anything that's brand related as a hoax and then work back from there. That happens is a marketing campaign.
That is really great strategy.
I guess it goes back to the clickbaity content. This sort of stuff will do really well traffic for a lot of sites. So do you just then play along with it because it will work out well for you and for what your site is after, or do you actually, treat your readers with a bit of respect and look into it a bit more? I think that's probably the best way to look at it.
Yeah, there was a Pizza Hut thing recently. They've started making all these Pizza Huts with various things in them, like meat pies and Vegemite crust and all these kind of iconic Australian food types, stuffing them into the pizza. And so many outlets, including The Guardian and big name, news outlets were going crazy for it. And it does make you feel like we could do it, but man, I just don't, and it's going to get a heap of clicks, but you've got to toss up, is it worth it?
I think it's about trying to find, if you know it's going to get heaps of clicks, if you can do it in a cynical way, maybe you won't alienate your audience.
Yeah, if we ever write about brands, we always try and inject just one sentence that's a little bit meta and a little bit negative about the brand to make it just clear that we're not buddying up with them.
According to the press release.
Do you think this kind of astroturfing stuff has the potential to backfire on a brand?
Oh, hugely. I think it's proven that it does. I think there was a case in 2009 when Witchery, they had some video campaign. It was a girl who found a jacket on a train belonging to a guy she had a crush on and did this video being like, I need to find this man, and had the jacket up. And it turned out she was an actor hired by a marketing company that had been employed by Witchery to get the brand awareness out. And that hugely backfired on Witchery.
We're still talking about it on radio, though, 4 years later.
I guess. Yeah, you're right. I just mentioned Witchery. Seven times.
I think if the brand is knows the danger of doing it, as someone who's worked both sides of the fence and still continue to do work both sides of the fence, and that is PR, branded PR, and also regular content. If you can educate your brand, if you can educate your client into the downfalls and pitfalls of it, and know and tell them, hey, this is what could happen, but when this happens, you just need to roll with it lean into it and really take ownership of what's happened, because it is a game and you did beat them, and here is. And good on them. They did their jobs as journalists. So you just need to kind of force yourself to acknowledge that hey, you got us. Hey, thanks for talking about us. And if that happens, that's great. Dick Smith, who I've worked with a number of times, he is the master at this crazy stuff. And he's done lots of things. I made an ad for him a couple of years ago called I like Dick. It was about Dick Smith Food Products. It was hilarious. We got it banned, but anyway. The point is, before the first thing he ever did, how Dick Smith made his first bucket of money, he sold petrol powered pogo sticks, and he called the Sydney Morning Herald to say, "Hey, I'm going to ride my petrol powered pogo stick across the Sydney Harbour Bridge." This is in the '60s, and he had a petrol powered pogo stick, and it wouldn't, the thing is, it wouldn't jump more than like six steps. So he just walked it to the toll booth, got a photo up of him going through the toll booth, paying the toll, and then the thing broke down after the toll booth, and then the guy ran it in the paper, and he sold like 10,000 in a space of like a few months, and that's how he started Dick Smith Electronics with that money. Really extraordinary. So if you're ready for that kind of, if you can own the downside to it, then as a brand, you actually win.
Well, we should say we actually can't prove anything. So if you manage to find a tub of the Gay Time ice cream, enjoy it with a clear conscience. And we have a question from a listener on our last topic. Anthony asks, what does the panel think of Facebook publishing their own content?
I think this is what we were talking about before. Mm. Yeah. Well, I'm not a publisher, the best, you know.
Yeah. I mean, so, okay. As I said before, I think that it's that kind of thing where you have to play along. So if Facebook turns, you know, at the moment they're experimenting with bigger, much bigger publications than Junkie. But if it turns out that we need to play along, we're just going to have to do it. And everyone in the industry is crossing their fingers that the revenue share is going to be beneficial to the publisher. But basically, they just get to write the rules and we have to play along. So it feels uncomfortable. It means that less people are going to be clicking through to the sites and we have to find ways around it, whether that means, you know, making it native content or something else where it's not relying on ad impressions. We're not really sure what we're going to do if that time comes, but we'll just have to play along.
I interpreted that question as meaning if Facebook becomes a publisher itself.
I can't really see that being...
The case, because, you know, Facebook's all about everyone else's voice rather than Facebook itself. But I guess it's not that different from, you know, ANZ does the Blue Notes thing now where it's them as a news site. And you've got to wonder, a lot of these companies, they, you know, they are getting more into the being their own voice and being their own sort of news outlet type thing. But how do they therefore establish, I guess, editorial independence from the company that they are? Do they ever report on the company that they are? I mean, AFL has the same problem as well. They've got a whole bunch of journalists working for them now. And you know, are they going to be able to adequately report on issues about the AFL as employees of the AFL? So I think that's something that people will probably, similar to, I guess, the clickbait, the you know, marketing type stuff, if people smell something wrong with the reporting, they'll realise it.
Yeah, this is it's really interesting, like from a journalist perspective and a content creator's perspective, as the media is fragmentizing, the new opportunities are at all these brands who are trying to be voices in their own markets. And that's so excruciatingly bad for editorial, but really good for my pay packet. But it also means that, you know, you got to straddle worlds and compromise yourself and, you know, do things you don't want to do. When it comes to native publishing natively, during my time at AJ Plus, we would publish videos on Facebook and also on YouTube and Twitter as well natively. Now, when we would share a link through our Facebook page, Facebook would also retrograde the YouTube links down and really, when it came to Facebook video and YouTube video, Facebook would favor its native content about 600% more than it would favor a YouTube link. And so that is really a pain in the ass. And so that's why we really, truly, while we're at AJ Plus, it lent into Facebook and really embraced Facebook video as our main outlet for content. And that's why AJ Plus video is doing so well at the moment, because everything is geared for Facebook first and then YouTube second. YouTube becomes the second platform.
This is Fourth Estate. My name's Lucy Robson, joined by Steph Harmon, Dan Illick and Josh Taylor. Now, the long Q&A saga may be at an end, as the ABC board has last week voted to move this show from its original division of TV into news and current affairs. This was a specific request from Tony Abbott to the chairman, James Spiegelman. Apparently, the government is pleased and front benches have permission to appear on the show once more. Now, we could speak kind of for half an hour about whether this is a sign of what's happening with the ABC's independence, but instead I'm just going to ask whether you guys are excited that front benches are going to be back on Q&A.
I think that it's been really engaging without them, so I'm not that looking forward to it.
Yeah, Neil deGrasse Tyson every week, please.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm also a fewer politicians on Q&A. I think the whole format needs an overhaul. It's very, very tired. It's been, 7 years now, and I think it's so predictable now when politicians are on that it's not as engaging as it once was.
I was hosting breakfast radio the other day, and I had a politician on, and he was the worst person I spoke to in 3 weeks of doing breakfast radio.
Who was it?
Small business minister for New South Wales, someone, I don't know.
Okay,
and he
don't
just came on and he just came on and started rattling off talking points. And I had to say, oh, the minister's definitely on his talking points this morning. If you want to talk like a human, please, you know, you're welcome to. I want to have a conversation with you. I don't want to be, this is not a press conference.
Yeah, there's a lot of like kind of details surfacing. No one really knows yet what it means for Q&A, but I think, you know, a lot of people, there's rumours that it's going to be not live anymore. And if it turns into just like stilted conversations between politicians who are just not responding to questions and towing party line even more than they already do.
To my knowledge, it doesn't effectively change too much about it. It's really just a different person is in charge of it.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure Pete McAvoy will still be EP of it, but he just won't answer to the head of entertainment. He will answer to the head of news. So what it is a funding thing as well. So there'll be a huge amount of money set aside for it in entertainment, and they'll just move that money to a different money box. And that's really kind of about it, and they might have to watch their balance more, but I shouldn't think it would change too much.
I did read a delightful rumor, I think on Crikey Josh, that maybe it might mean that the tweets go, ha, that'd be great.
No tweets.
Yeah,
God damn it. We might have to read our tweets on Twitter. Oh, God. Natively.
The competition to get tweets on screen just means that people just, you know, tweet. I don't know. It'd be interesting to watch how the pattern of tweets changes if they're not in competition to try and get an on-screen tweet.
Why don't we just not have guests and just do tweets?
I will not be tweeting again if that happens. The only reason why I watch Q&A is to get a tweet on screen. That's the only reason.
Media Watch does 15 minutes of tweets just before the show anyway, so it's not really required anyway.
Can they please do something with Media Watch? Can they make that more exciting? I don't know, add music or do something more than what they do. It hasn't changed in like 40 years.
Is this your pitch for a job on Media Watch?
I've got too many jobs. I don't need that one.
All right. Well, we are unfortunately out of time before the state. Thanks to my guests, Steph Harmon from Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Taylor from Crikey and Dan Illick, investigative humorist. You can listen to our podcast on 2SER.com and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Next up on the 2SER is On The Money, and the team are looking at the Hutchison Ports protests and what economic lessons Australia can learn from Canada. Then stay tuned for Infinite X and the first of a series of reports on safe spaces for women. Fourth Estate is produced at the studios of 2SER and broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network. My name's Lucy Robson, and we're back next week.